This is Audible.
Avid Audiobooks presents The Delusion by Laura Gallier, narrated by Jonathan Todd Ross.
A quote from Dr. Charles F. Stanley. It doesn't matter whether you want to be in a spiritual battle. You are in one. The battle is between good and evil, and you are the prize. Prologue. It was bad enough I had to up and move in the middle of my senior year, but to be the new guy at a high school where 8 students had committed suicide since September, I felt cursed. By spring break, 3 more students were gone. 11 total, dead. But that wasn't the worst of it. Even though the students died by their own hands, their deaths were provoked. And I'm the only one who could see what tormented them. Believe me, I tried to warn people. I begged them to listen. But they wouldn't. Not even the people closest to me. Chances are you won't take me seriously either. My stories are twisted and bizarre, and so terrifying that I'm sometimes told to shut up a few minutes into them. But I can't. And who knows? Maybe you're one of the rare ones, one of a small minority willing to venture beyond your 5 senses to believe in what is rarely seen, what intentionally stays hidden. What I wished I'd never seen. It all began on a typical Monday morning. Well, typical for me. Chapter 1. A deep guttural growl jarred my eyes open. It was so dark I couldn't see a thing, but I knew where the sound was coming from. Exactly where she was, crouched low to the floor. My psychotic dog was at it again. I didn't move. Maybe she'd give up and lie down. For once, let it go. Whatever it was. But she kept on, this time with a snarl. I had no choice but to throw my sheets back and peer over the foot of my bed. Stop it, girl. It's okay. Labrador retrievers are known for their protective instincts, but my dog's senses were way off. More nights than not, she'd fixate on my closed bedroom door and growl like an axe murderer was stomping down the hallway. I tapped the mattress. Daisy, get up here. She didn't budge. Come on, girl, nothing's there. This time I was wrong. My door flung open and collided with the wall, sending Daisy scurrying under the bed and me scrambling to my feet. A silhouette stood in the doorway, framed by the hall light. This was no axe murderer. Still, I wasn't entirely relieved. Mom, what does she want now? She steadied herself against the doorframe, her hair still wrapped in a towel from last night's bath. Her pasty white bird legs looked even thinner than usual. Owen? Don't step in here. Don't come in my room. She usually ended up knocking something over. And somehow she'd always make it my fault. I grabbed my cell off my nightstand. 6:03 a.m. She managed to slur a few words, but I interrupted. Go lie down, Mom. I'll make breakfast in a minute. A half hour later, I had gotten dressed, fed my dog, pressed start on the coffee maker, and was sorting through the mail left in a heap by the microwave. My stomach leaped into my throat when I came across a slim letter stamped with a cardinal red logo. Finally, the letter I'd been waiting for, working my guts out for, since my freshman year. I exhaled, trying to rid my body of nervous tension. I didn't get anxious very often, but this was Stanford, my dream university. I tore into the envelope. In less than 60 seconds, I'd know if I'd succeeded or bombed. I read at warp speed. Admissions committee carefully reviewed, much consideration, regret to inform you that your application... And just like that, my number one goal was face down in the water. I wanted to protest, to somehow convince the letter to change its mind and rewrite itself. But reality began to seep in like the damp cold of the drizzling rain outside. It occurred to me that maybe my mother was right, that I was too ambitious. Maybe the world had enough doctors already. I crumpled the letter with the rest of the junk mail and hurled the wad clear across the kitchen. It felt good seeing it slam into the recycle bin. Maybe if there hadn't been a sink full of dishes, I would have sat and sulked. I rinsed my mom's sticky wine glasses, battling the sting of disappointment. It's not the end of the world, I reminded myself. I'd already been accepted to my hometown university, Boston College. Hardly a bad plan B. And it fulfilled my second biggest goal, to get out of Masonville, Texas, for good. I'd been here 3 months, and still couldn't get used to seeing cattle graze next to busy streets. I stared at the wet streaks on the kitchen window and shook my head. Another dreary day. It was like a gang of storm clouds stalked this hill country town, bringing downpours and gloom and charcoal-colored sunsets. But the press loved the weather. The ominous drizzle was the perfect backdrop for their never-ending news coverage about the Masonville High suicides. Sure enough, on the TV mounted to the kitchen wall, a reporter was going on and on about the deaths. She was interviewing some psychiatrist whose big words failed to offer any solutions. What would cause a whole string of people to murder themselves? As much as I prided myself on having logical answers for everything in life, this was beyond me. I wiped dishes dry while footage played from the last town hall meeting. Same as all the others. Sobbing mothers, finger-pointing fathers, school administrators pleading with the crowd to stay calm. Then it was back to the know-it-all reporter. She was one of the worst. With every suicide at my school, she was among the first to flock to our campus in a race to broadcast the latest tragedy. It was like having ravenous vultures perched over you every day, watching you, licking their beaks. Thanks to the media, the nation was now captivated by the so-called Masonville suicide saga. It was reporters like this one who made our brand new school out to be the eighth wonder of the world, the ultimate reality freak show. I'd go to class today knowing that people all over the world were on the edge of their seats, wondering who would off themselves next, and how. This was not how I'd envisioned my senior year. I texted my kind of girlfriend, Jess. About to leave. We'd been spending time together for 2 months now, but had yet to make it official. I wasn't big on commitment, and I guess she picked up on that. I carried some buttered toast and a cup of coffee into the living room for my mom, who was sprawled on the sofa. Why was she lounging around while I made breakfast? This was my life. Most days I was pretty good at dealing with it. Today, not so much. But it wasn't all bad. With the exception of her constantly correcting my grammar and making me learn a new Latin word every week or so, she pretty much left me to myself. I set the food on the coffee table, along with a bill she needed to pay today. 2 weeks ago, actually. Then I grabbed my backpack and headed out the door to see my baby, my 1986 Ducati Scrambler motorcycle. Iconic yellow panels. My mom may have been a near failure as a parent, but she managed to do a few things right, like get me this Italian bike 2 years ago for my 16th birthday. It needed some work, but I couldn't complain. It was a classic. Thankfully, today it started right up. 10 minutes later, I pulled into Jess's circular driveway and stared at her mammoth house, a stark contrast to my place. It's not that my mom couldn't afford better. We were living in her childhood home, because it had been willed to me by her parents. To me, even though my mom hadn't spoken to them in decades, and I seriously had no idea they even knew I existed. The plan was to fix up the place and sell it for a decent profit. And the key to the house showed up just in time, when we needed to get out of Boston fast. I never did understand how my mom managed to bank a six-figure income while working a few hours here and there as an online tutor, and I didn't really care to ask. But with Jess's dad, there was no mystery. He was a real estate genius. I sent Jess a text, then ran up the slippery steps to her front porch, holding the new pink helmet I'd gotten her. When she didn't come out, I grabbed the thick knocker on her front door and hit it against the mahogany. And there I stood. And stood. By now the drizzle had picked up. I texted Jess again, then looked toward the three-car garage. The door was open. Weird. As usual, Mr. Thompson's Tesla was gone, but so was Mrs. Thompson's SUV. Jess's convertible was the only vehicle there. I knocked again, with my fist this time, and rang the doorbell. It chimed like a pipe organ. Nothing. I called Jess's cell, straight to voicemail. "Stay calm," I texted. "Where are you? You okay?" I sucked in a damp, deep breath and ran into the garage. It wasn't my place to go barging in, but the door to the house was locked anyway. I tried knocking again. Still, no answer. I hurried to my bike, glancing back at the front door through the rain, then put my helmet on and sat with the engine off. I didn't care that I was getting soaked. My pulse pounded against my watch. I forced myself to breathe deep, squeezing my handlebar grips. Most people in my shoes wouldn't be so alarmed, but most people weren't burying classmates every few weeks. Truth is, I'd been worried about Jess. She'd seemed down lately. She'd get quiet all of a sudden, and not even our inside jokes would get a laugh out of her. When I'd ask what was wrong, she'd just shrug. I hated that. Still, no word from her. So I started my bike and pulled back onto the street. I noticed an old man in a white vintage-looking pickup truck parked across the street. More like he noticed me. He stared a hole through me, then tipped his cowboy hat. I gave somewhat of a nod, then took off, hardly touching the brake all the way to school. Maybe Jess's mom had driven her, but wouldn't Jess have told me? She'd been riding to school with me every day for a month now. Our bonding time, she called it. Unwelcome images paraded through my mind, vivid and colorful. Jess on her bedroom floor, not breathing. An empty pill bottle a few inches from her open palm. Maybe her mother is rushing her to the hospital right now. That would explain the garage door left open, the missing SUV, Jess's parked car. I exhaled, slow and steady. Jess would never hurt herself, would she? I played my music through my earphones, but that didn't stop the mental footage. A school-wide announcement, a funeral procession. Me in my new black suit I'd worn way too many times already. I turned my music up. Jess is fine. I'll see her in a few minutes at school. Nothing to worry about. I wiped blobs of rain off my helmet visor, and by the time I neared the intersection two blocks from my school, I could see better. Unfortunately. Religious fanatics surrounded our campus. They shouted and held up signs, protesting as if our suicidal student body were defiling their holy planet. Their posters said all kinds of cruel, idiotic things. My personal favorite? Satan lives at Masonville High. I shook my head. Just yesterday, I'd vented to Jess that if Satan did exist, he'd be outside waving a sign with them. From day one, the protesters had creeped Jess out. "Why do they hate us so much?" she'd say. I'd just sigh. Who cares? But I had to admit the hostile scene was becoming unnerving, especially today. My stomach hurt, sloshing with nervous adrenaline, and these people were not helping me fight the urge to puke. A lanky guy with stringy red hair shook a fist. It's the end of the world! Repent or perish! Wouldn't you know it, traffic stopped, putting me next to him for a good 2 minutes. Let's just say that if looks really could kill, I would have flatlined. The light changed, and the freak ran alongside me, shouting nonsense. I made a hand gesture to let him know what I thought of his hate speech. Eyes back on the road, I instantly squeezed hard on the brake, unable to breathe. Television network vans lined the curb outside my school. That obnoxious reporter was scurrying to get in front of a camera. Please, not Jess. Chapter 2. A dozen news crews stood in the rain. Drivers honked. Protesters glared. Catatonic students huddled under umbrellas, gawking at the chaos. It was a familiar scene I could never get used to. Teachers motioned for students to get inside the building, but most didn't budge. What could the administrators do about it? All I cared about was asking around until I found a name for suicide number 12. I parked crooked and jumped off my bike, desperately scanning the parking lot. Jess always stood out, but today? Where can she be? More tormenting mental images. I spotted one of Jess's friends, Ashlyn, on the front steps of the school. Hey, have you seen... The red-haired nut shoved between Ashlyn and me, planting himself in front of me like he was executing a man-to-man defensive move. Repent! God is punishing you! I could see now, through the slimy strands of hair stuck to his face, that one of his eye sockets was missing an eyeball. An observation I could have lived without. Move! I pushed past him, nearly knocking him over. Child of Satan! Judgment is coming! I wanted to unleash my own judgment, but an out-of-breath police officer got a hold of the kook, gripping his arm and knocking his pathetic sign to the ground. Time to go, the cop said. You're not allowed on school property. The man flailed his arms and yelled something about the First Amendment, but the officer yanked harder, forcing him away. Finally, some justice. I lost sight of Ashlyn, but caught up with Stella Murphy and some guy as I sloshed through puddles, drenching the bottom half of my jeans. Who was it? Don't know yet. The guy sipped some Coke through a curvy straw. But I heard it was a girl. Alcohol and sleeping pills. I strained to breathe. Either of you guys seen Jess? My voice cracked. Stella painted on lip gloss. No. Coke sipper shook his head. I took off toward the school. I had no idea where to look for her, but I wasn't just going to stand around. I was nearing the entrance doors when I felt a hand on my shoulder. I turned, and my world was bearable again. Jess. I hugged her as tight as I could, almost suffocating us both. Where were you? I was panting like I'd just run a marathon. She clung so hard to my shoulders that her feet came off the ground. Finally, we let go. I told you. I had tutorials this morning, remember? She hadn't told me, but I had no desire to try and prove her wrong. I saw your car in the garage, and I thought... I had my mom drive me. She pulled me close again. That way, I can ride home with you. That's what I thought. I just... Never mind. I rested my chin on top of her head, holding her umbrella over us as the morbid images I'd had of her surrendered to peace of mind. Stella caught up with us and wedged herself under our umbrella. It was Emma Lancaster. Emma is number 12? Jess's lips quivered. She's in my third period class. Stella's eyes narrowed and she leaned even closer. She was in your third period class. Jess's chin dropped and her shoulders slumped. I felt like I was watching her sink into an emotional pit, the same hole I'd been trying to pull her out of for about a week. So much for peace of mind. Suddenly, some man was there, holding out a microphone, motioning to us from the curb. The light on the TV camera made us all squint. Great. The last thing we needed was a nosy reporter butting into our lives. Tell me, any of you know Emma? Did you know she was having suicidal thoughts?
I knew her, Jess said. But, I mean, I didn't...
I knew her super well. Stella grinned like a pageant girl. She seemed, like, a little down the last few weeks, but we're all kind of down, you know? There was no disguising her excitement at appearing on TV. How's my hair? She whispered to Jess. Disgusting. Really? Stella fluffed her long hair with both hands. I was talking about you. Your hair looks fine. Typical Jess. No filter whatsoever.
We should go.
I grabbed Jess's hand, and we turned our backs on Stella and headed toward the school. I knew already not to press too hard trying to cheer Jess up. Still, I held out hope that we could get through another depressing school day, then put the stress and sadness behind us. I would have really liked to put the whole school year behind us, but with graduation more than 2 months away, the only option was to tough it out. I knew I had what it took, but Jess? We were almost inside when she dropped my hand and stopped walking. I turned to her. You okay? She stared up at me, exhaustion weighing on her flawless face.
I don't think I can take this anymore, Owen.
A voice came from behind us.
What do you mean by that, Jess Thompson?
Uh-oh. Principal Harding had appeared out of nowhere, looking pitiful. Swollen eyes, soggy hair, splattered rain boots.
I'm arranging for you to meet with a counselor today.
But I don't need to... It's not up for debate, Miss Thompson. Harding pulled a pink slip and a pen from her raincoat. Jess huffed.
You can take that paper and...
Of course she'll go, Miss Harding. I made wide eyes at Jess. She rolled hers, but a second later she flashed a small grin at me. I smiled back and winked.
Teacher's pet, she whispered in my ear before taking the slip from Miss Harding like an obedient child.
She gave me a bigger grin. Maybe I actually had managed to cheer her up. I'd at least managed to keep her from getting detention. The walk to Jess's first period class was gloomy. Most students were moving like zombies. A few hugged. Others zoned out, blocking everything with earphones. My favorite teacher at Masonville High, Miss Barnett, stood in the hallway smiling at everyone. Guess it was her attempt at spreading some joy. We needed it, seriously. It's hard to say whose fault it was, but as we neared Jess's classroom, she and a blonde girl majorly collided. Jess managed to hold on to her purse and backpack, but the other girl's stuff flew everywhere.
Really?
Jess tiptoed over the mess.
I didn't see you.
The soft-spoken girl looked up, but for less than a second. She dropped to the floor and started grabbing things.
It's fine, Jess said, without even looking at the girl.
Let's go. She pulled me toward her classroom.
Wait.
I bent down and grabbed a notebook and a few markers. Here.
Thanks.
I couldn't tell if the girl's cheeks were always that pink, or if she was embarrassed. And I couldn't remember her name. She'd been assigned to show me around the school on my first day, but I'd hardly seen her since.
Sorry.
I handed her another marker off the floor and nodded toward Jess.
She's been stressed lately.
Yeah.
The girl zipped her pencil bag.
She's been stressed since kindergarten.
I grinned and snorted. I couldn't help it.
What did you say?
Jess stepped toward the girl. She opened her mouth, but then turned and walked off. Jess huffed. That's what I thought. Easy, babe. I put my arm around her. Save some attitude for the counselor.
That's not funny.
I kind of thought it was, but I said sorry anyway. We hugged. Then she went to class. On the way to my classroom, I noticed two stern-looking men wearing rubber gloves rummaging through a locker down the row from mine. It had belonged to Emma Lancaster, number 12. I hadn't been friends with her, couldn't even picture her face, but it still made me queasy to think that we must have walked past each other almost every day. What could have been so bad about her life that she saw death as the only way out? I mean, my home life had to be as bad as anyone's, if not seriously worse, and I managed to keep it together. I made it to first period before the bell, but I doubt my teacher would have marked me tardy anyway. Not when news of another suicide had just hit. My friend Lance came up next to me, his girlfriend glued to his side. Number 12, dude. He ran his hands through his wavy blonde hair, then shook his head. I know. This school year can't end fast enough. I'd met Lance my first week at Masonville. He liked motorcycles as much as I did, but when I found out he was a Red Sox fan, I knew we'd be good friends. I sat at my desk and stared at the smart board, but didn't read it. Just thought about how another student was dead. Gone forever. And ever. At least I didn't know her, so I didn't have to go to her funeral. Two rows away from me was a vacant seat that, just a month ago, had belonged to Brady Hopkins, a popular guy who'd put his father's gun to his temple and pulled the trigger. I closed my eyes, but that only made it worse, the image of his empty chair cemented in my mind. I hated that chair. Why didn't someone just sit in it? Instead, it sat there, cold and lifeless, like Brady, a constant reminder that few things in life are as permanent as death. As usual, Principal Harding made an announcement encouraging students suffering grief over today's loss to go to the office and meet with a counselor. Also, as usual, the guy next to me talked over the announcement, bragging about everything from what size buck he'd shot over the weekend to how fast he'd driven his dad's Ferrari last night down a two-lane highway. Who hands their kid the keys to their Ferrari? I pretty much got along with everyone, except this guy, Dan. He was Jess's ex-boyfriend, but he couldn't seem to get the ex part through his head. He wanted her back bad, so of course he hated me.
Hey, Owen.
Dan talked loud enough for everyone to hear.
Your dad ever take you hunting?
He knew it was just my mom and me. I clenched my jaw and narrowed my eyes at him, ready to fire back. But our teacher stood front and center and told us to get our laptops out. She was looking right at me. That was the last complete sentence she said all period. The suicides were hard on us students, but even more draining on the teachers. I was told the first death back in September, when the school first opened, had been considered an isolated incident. But now? Suicide had become more like the plague, or like some sadistic lottery. Any minute, another student's number would be up. My third period teacher had us move our desks into a circle, then take turns sharing our opinions about why the suicides were happening. As usual, it was hard to get anyone to talk, and the ones who did had lame theories. One guy actually suggested it might have something to do with global warming. I sighed really loud. Lance and I were the first ones to make it to our lunch table. I intentionally sat with my back to the window. Outside was the morbid Rest in Peace fence, a makeshift memorial to the suicide victims. The chain links were covered top to bottom with balloons, stuffed animals, notes, whatever people could make stick. And there were photos of each suicide victim hung in chronological order, according to their last day on Earth. Jess always sat next to me, and I didn't want her having to stare at that. Lance looked at me with a sneaky grin. You asked Jess to prom yet? Talking about stuff like that helped our school day feel normal. Yeah.
Dang.
He pounded his fist on the table. You beat me to it. Yeah, right. Lance wasn't the type to move in on his friend's girl. And anyway, he and Megan had been together for 2 years. I liked Megan, but it got a little old the way they spent every second together. Lance and I had hardly been able to hang out, just the two of us.
Can I ask you something?
I leaned across the table.
How's Megan doing, you know, with the suicides?
Fine. He sipped his Dr. Pepper. She's good. Why?
Jess is getting, I don't know, down, I guess.
Yeah, Megan's been worried about her.
Really?
So it wasn't just me. After school, I sat on my motorcycle and waited for Jess. Most of the protesters were gone by then, but a few lingered in a nearby intersection. An Asian man rang a tarnished bell. He wore a sign that said, "Do you hear death?" No. A guy who looked like he'd quit his job with a traveling carnival stood across the street selling t-shirts that said, "I survived a semester at Masonville High." Even I knew that was tasteless. I looked out at the untouched land that surrounded the school. Tall grass framed by dense woods. It belonged to me, over 1,000 acres, part of the inheritance from my grandparents. The plan was to sell it along with the house, but my mom had yet to take initiative to call a real estate agent, or to make any improvements on the house. As Jess walked up, I noticed how gorgeous she looked, even in a plain t-shirt, her sun-glossed skin practically begging me to touch it. The holes in her high-dollar jeans were a major dress code violation, but I guess the teachers had given up on getting her to comply. I got my keys out. So how'd it go with the counselor? She sighed. Awesome. Ah, the one-word answer thing. I didn't like it, but I kept trying. You feeling better? She climbed on my bike and wrapped her arms around me. It felt good. Really good. I know what you're thinking, Owen. The counselor taught you to read minds? My stab at comic relief fell flat. You think I'm gonna get depressed and go off and... Shut up, Jess. She leaned to the side and glared at me. I didn't mean to yell at her, but I didn't feel like apologizing either. She'd never once apologized to me. But more than that, I meant what I'd said. I was sick of talking about death, sick of dreary moods and sulky conversations, and I didn't want to hear the word suicide one more time. I started my bike, and an idea came to me. Once we got past the parking lot traffic, I sped down the side street beside the school, but instead of heading toward Jess's neighborhood, I veered off the road onto the uncut grass. I made a sharp turn down a dirt trail and drove fast, snaking through 40-foot pine trees. Technically my trees on my property. The rumble of my motorcycle sent birds into flight. Jess squeezed tighter. I couldn't see her smiling, but I knew she was. Surrounded entirely by woods now, I slid to a stop. I'd barely parked my bike when Jess jumped down and took off running like a track star, giggling, darting down a slippery hillside. I laughed and chased after her. Mud flung from her ankle boots and hit me in the chest. I resisted the urge to pass her and let her lead the way to what was becoming our spot in the woods. a patch of rocks peeking out from the brush under a tight cluster of towering trees. This is where we came on days like today, when the world was closing in and suffocating us. I love that feeling of being out of breath, but unable to wipe the grin off my face. We collapsed on the rocks, knowing any second the moisture would seep through our clothes. Jess crossed her arms over her bent knees and sucked in air. I did the same. Other than an occasional bird chirp, the only sound was our heavy breathing. Slowly, I caught my breath. The stampede in my heart became a mild thump, and my arms and legs started to relax. "You hear from any universities?" Jess gripped my hand. "Stanford is a no."
"Really?"
She sounded more relieved than concerned.
"Boston College?"
I stared at the dirt. "Nah, not yet." I was sure that, had I told her the truth, it would have just made her sad. "Your grades are awesome, Owen. I know you'll get in." She gazed above my head. "I have no clue what I'm gonna do. But I have to get out of my house, out of this jacked-up town." Jess was smart, but she pretty much blew off school, so there weren't many options for her now. She dropped her chin. "My dad is really disappointed. All my cousins are at Ivy League schools." I reached over and ran my fingers through her silky, chocolate-brown hair, then rubbed my hand across her shoulders. I made my way to the back of her neck, thinking maybe I could massage away some of her stress. "Things will work out," I said. Honestly, I wasn't sure where she'd end up, and I was even less sure what would become of us. As much as we liked each other, our future was as clear as the mud caked on our shoes. Jess looked me in the face. "Owen, do you ever feel like depressed sometimes?" "Ugh. I brought her here to get away from depression, not talk about it. But there was no way I was going to tell her to shut up twice in one day. I'm not that stupid." She turned to face me. "There's this heavy feeling that weighs down on me sometimes, almost like it's pressing on my chest or something. Like this." She swallowed hard. "Like this misery that creeps up all of a sudden. Do you know what I mean?" Yet another drastic mood change. I felt like I was swinging at a curveball I never saw coming. "Is it like a sad feeling?" She picked up a rock and threw it, visibly disappointed that I couldn't relate. "It's more than feeling down. It's like this awful emptiness drops over me for no reason at all. It happens during random times at school or when I'm alone in my room. Do you ever feel that?" "Feelings are overrated, Jess. I live by what I know, the facts." "It's like this eerie unhappiness that follows me around." Clearly, she'd given no thought to what I'd just said. "And even though I try super hard to ignore it, it finds me, especially when I lie down to sleep. It's like turning the light off signals this miserable feeling to seek me out. And I wonder if that's what happened to Brady Hopkins and Emma Lancaster and the others. Were they so smothered by this feeling that they decided to end it all?" I was at a loss, and more worried than ever about Jess. She scooted closer to me. "This girl today was talking about how Emma said she heard voices, and now she's number 12. Crazy, huh?" "They make meds for stuff like that, Jess." I cupped her face and lifted her eyes to meet mine. "Promise me that no matter what you're feeling, no matter what's going through your head, you won't do something stupid, something permanent. 'Cause if you did, I..." "Shh." She slapped her palm over my mouth. It hurt, but I didn't let her know it. "You hear that?" Her eyes darted in one direction, then another, while the rest of her body stayed frozen. There's something here.
Chapter 3.
You don't hear that?
She stared deep into the woods, not blinking.
Nope.
Okay, so I was picking up on something, but it was faint, and I was hoping she'd drop it. I wanted to get beyond talking and on to other things.
Let's not worry about...
I think it's underneath us. What is that?
Once Jess made up her mind, that was it. I gave up on getting my way and made somewhat of an effort to listen.
It's probably a drainage ditch or something. It's been raining for days.
It sounded like rapids, liquid tumbling and sloshing.
Seriously, Owen? It's way bigger than a drainpipe. Listen.
I couldn't have cared less, but out of respect for her, I closed my eyes and silenced my breathing. Sure enough, I not only heard it, I felt it. Something stirring below ground.
Maybe there's an underground spring.
I leaned back against a rock, straightened my legs, and folded my hands behind my head. My work was done.
So, you're just gonna sit there?
Should have known.
All right, Jess, I'll see what I can find.
It didn't take long to notice that the deeper I went into the woods, Jess on my heels, the louder the odd sound got. We walked for what had to be at least half a mile, stepping over unearthed tree roots and piles of leaves reduced to wet globs of brown. I arrived at a thick wall of brush and branches and looked back at her.
You really want me to get through all this?
Of course she did. I kicked some of the limbs, breaking them in half, then pulled at the entangled clutter. Jess helped too. When a few holes opened up, we stopped and peeked through. Jess gasped.
What's this?
I scanned the scene. A large enclosed clearing in the woods, so dark that it already looked like dusk in there. I kicked harder now, eventually making a gap we were both able to squeeze through. We stepped into the dirt-covered area, a thick line of trees framing a nearly perfect circle of empty space, about 30 feet across if I had to guess. Jess clutched my hand, and we walked to the center, then stood back to back looking up. Sprawling oak trees formed a ceiling high above our heads, the branches interlocked like bony fingers so that minimal sunlight broke through. It made sense that it was much drier and cooler inside here. The tree cover was like an immovable dark umbrella. In a way, it was scenic, but way too dingy to be pretty. Jess spun around slowly, taking it in.
This is your property, right?
Yeah. It was weird to think I owned this. Given the sound and feel of movement beneath our feet, it seemed if we reached down, we'd touch turbulent water. But there was nothing but dry dirt and crunchy leaves. Jess wandered to the edge of the tree line.
Check this out.
A web of vines concealed a red brick water well, weathered and cracked. A rope hung from an old but sturdy wooden crankshaft, mounted to the well. I leaned forward and gave the rope a tug.
This thing has to be 100 years old.
Jess put her cell in flashlight mode, then shined it down. It's hard to say how far down the bottom really was, but it was deep enough that I felt kind of queasy leaning over the side. Nothing but a worn wooden bucket on the ground down there, still attached to the rope. The earth was so dry the mud was cracked. Jess and I walked around the clearing some more, but we never did locate any water. Suddenly, something made an eerie, high-pitched howl. I would have sworn it was an owl, but Jess got spooked. We'd walked nearly all the way back to my motorcycle when she stopped and yelled my name. I thought she'd spotted a venomous snake or something.
I left my cell phone in that dungeon.
I didn't waste time getting frustrated. Just did the manly thing and started back while she sat on my bike and played music on my phone. It wasn't hard to spot her neon pink phone case on the ledge of the well. I grabbed it and turned to go. But this time, I got spooked. Something was rustling in the trees. Not like a creature scurrying along the ground or birds fluttering leaves, but something big, heavy-footed, headed toward the clearing. All I had time to do was duck behind the well. I held my breath and waited. Then, it took me a minute to make sense of what I was seeing. An old man in overalls and a cowboy hat, clutching a large pair of limb cutters. He started whistling an upbeat song as he headed straight for the well. I didn't want to startle him, but I saw no point in hiding anymore. I rose slowly. He saw me but didn't flinch, just smiled and kept coming toward me. I recognized him now. This was the man I'd seen outside Jess's house this morning. The one who'd stared at me from inside his white pickup.
"You here to help?"
He smiled wide. "Help?" He didn't pause, just started cutting vines away from the well. He worked like he had the strength of a young man. The whole scenario was super weird. He nodded toward Masonville High.
"You go to that new school over there."
Seemed like it should have been a question. I went ahead and said, "Yeah."
"Tragedy ever since those doors opened." He shook his head. "Untold loss."
I nodded, then peered into the distance, anxious to get back to Jess. Of course I had questions I'd have liked to ask this guy. Like, where had he come from? And why bother with this useless well? But I couldn't stand here all day. I was about to say see ya and go, when he stopped snipping, leaned the cutters against the side of the well, and looked at me. I mean looked at me. Like he had that morning. Like he was staring through my skin. I swallowed hard, fidgeted, but couldn't shake the awkward feeling, like I was standing there naked. His brown eyes were as dark as his skin, yet had a golden tint I'd never seen before. They struck me as kind but intense. I felt the need to look away.
"How about you and I have a drink?"
He turned to the well and began to crank the handle. "That's okay. I need to get back. There's a girl waiting on me."
"You worried about her?"
I didn't know if he meant right now or in general, but I said yes. Either way, it was true.
"This town could use a young man like you. One who looks out for others."
He'd nearly hoisted the bucket to the top by now. "Just so you know," I told him, "that well's dry."
"No, it's not."
Yeah, it is." I tried not to sound rude. "We just shined a light down there."
"No, it isn't."
One more turn of the handle and the bucket was up, sloshing over with water. I saw it, and it was definitely dry. The man let out a hearty laugh, then pulled two paper cuffs from his pocket. He blew in them and used his finger to wipe particles out.
"Gross."
He scooped water into both cups, then handed me one. It was torn along the rim, used for all I knew. He lifted his cup as if to say, "Cheers," then downed the water.
No way I was drinking that water, especially after I looked in the cup. "There's stuff floating in here."
He grinned. "City boys, think a piece of dirt's gonna kill 'em." I hadn't told him I'd moved here from the city, but I figured my accent tipped him off. I tried to hand the cup back, but he wouldn't take it.
"Go on."
He had a gentle smile. "I'll pass. I reminded him that someone was waiting on me, then felt the need to add, "My guess is this water is loaded with bacteria." I dumped it out, then crushed the cup. He took it from me this time. I thought for sure he'd back off now, but as I turned to go, he piped up. Brave enough to save his mama's life, but scared of a little sip of water. I froze, then spun around. "What did you say?" I hadn't told anyone what had happened the night my mom and I left Boston for Texas, and I was sure she hadn't either. I had no intention of ever telling that story. But it was true, what the man had just said. "How did you know that?" He smiled bigger and raised his cup. "Let's have a drink." That was it. All the strangeness I could take. "I've got to go." I took off again, faster this time. As I was about to squeeze out of there, I mumbled to myself, "This town's messed up." "Sure is," he said, somehow hearing me from all the way across the clearing. "Been messed up for a long time." And with that, he went back to trimming, apparently content for me to go. But I just stood there. There was something this man wasn't telling me. Chapter 4. I didn't stand there long before the man asked me another question, still working to tame the chaos of vines around the well. "You have ideas about what's causing the suicides?" From across the clearing, I made my best attempt at a logical theory. "Seems to me some people are strong and others not so much. The weak ones can't handle life's pressures. They give up and end it all. Then the stress of the suicides causes other weak people to give in to it themselves. It's a vicious cycle." "I see," he said. He didn't seem impressed by my answer. "What about you?" He'd put me on the spot. It seemed fair to do the same to him. "You have a theory?" The old man turned to face me. "Sabotage." "Huh?" What was he talking about? I walked fast to the center of the clearing. "You're saying someone's plotting the suicides?" He nodded, his cowboy hat bobbing up and down. "How's that possible? Suicide is self-inflicted." The man rubbed his hands together, wiping away dirt. "Suicide is provoked every time." His voice echoed off the trees. I furrowed my brow. "What do you mean?" He swept our surroundings with a glance but said nothing. "Provoked by who?" I probed again. He just went back to trimming. That's when it clicked. This man was a conspiracy theorist, irrational, deranged for all I knew. Maybe even a protester along with the other psychos that flocked to my school. I was out of there. I drove Jess home, we said our goodbyes, and I watched her step inside her marble-floored house. I decided to put the weird man in overalls out of my mind, but on my way home, our conversation gnawed at me. How'd he know about my mom? And that well? It was dry, I was sure of it. But the bucket came up full. I was still some distance away when I spotted a truck parked in my driveway. A blue Chevy I'd never seen before. I pulled up next to it, killed my bike's engine, and sat there, knowing full well what would happen next. I'd open the front door and find some man on the sofa next to my mom. She'd jump up and introduce me to the guy like there was nothing disgusting about the situation. "No, thank you." I took off. Minutes later, I was blazing down the dirt trail behind Masonville High, then charging through the woods on foot, headed back to the murky clearing. It was sunset by the time I got there, and nearly pitch black inside the tree-shaded circle. I used my cell to light my steps, determined to take a closer look at the well. There was no way I'd get my brain to stop turning long enough to fall asleep tonight if I didn't figure this out. Yeah, it was eerie here at night, but I wasn't about to chicken out. I pressed my waist against the brick ledge and leaned over the well, careful not to drop my cell. Just like I thought, there was no water down there. Not a drop. I was about to turn the handle, but the instant I reached for it, something pressed down hard on my shoulder. My heart nearly leaped out of my chest. I spun around, out of breath, working hard to steady my light. "What are you doing here?" I'm sure I sounded angry. The old man stood a foot away, smiling at me from the blanket of black that engulfed the clearing. "Had a feeling you'd be back." "So, you were waiting for me?" I found that odd, really odd. He walked past me and sat on the brick ledge. "You have an interest in my water well?" "Actually, I cleared my throat. It's my well. I own all this." His eyebrows shot straight up. "So this is your property?" I picked up on some sarcasm, like he was a step ahead of me. "Well then, want a drink from your well?" "No, sir, I want an explanation. How do you know about my life?" I pointed to the well. "And how do you draw water from a dry source?" He gave a long exhale. "I imagine you're like most people. Have to see to believe." He crossed his arms. "Problem is, some things you have to believe, or you never will see." "What are you talking about?" He began to turn the handle. "What do you plan to do with your life, young man?" "Get back to Boston, become a doctor." "You want to save lives?" "Yes, sir, I do." He paused his hoisting of the rope. "Young people are dying, son, right here at your school. An entire town in upheaval, demanding to know why, guessing at what to do." "And?" I took a step toward him, still shining my cell light. "What can I do?" A few more cranks, and the bucket dangled over the well, water spilling over. It made no more sense than it had the first time. "How's that happening?" I demanded. The old man reached into the pocket of his denim overalls and, like before, pulled out two paper cups. He extended one to me. "Some things only make sense in hindsight." I was getting irritated now, but I did my best to keep being polite. "Look, I want you to tell me who you are and what's going on." I shined my light on the overflowing bucket, then back on his face. "Please, I came here for answers." He grinned, then scooped water into the cups. Held one out to me yet again. I sighed, my irritation out in the open now. I took the cup and stared at it. Wait. The rim was ripped in the exact same place as before. I crushed this cup, but it's not creased. The man shrugged. I used my finger to pull out a floating speck. "What's the point of this?" "Some things only make sense in hindsight, got it." I shook my head, huffed, eyed the water. "I drink this, you talk. Get all the answers you want." He lifted his cup to chin level. "And then some." I raised the cup to my lips, gave a reluctant sigh. "Utcumque." Latin for whatever. And with that, I leaned my head back and swigged it down. The water tasted normal. The old man drained his cup, then just stood there, staring at me. So? I crushed the cup again.
So?
He stood. Now, I go. He walked.